All right. Welcome back. I hope your Pesach was beautiful. We are at the end of Parakah, the end of chapter 20. And we're going to do a little bit of a recap of where we are, because Pesach. This story began for us way back when, in Perek Yotet, in chapter 19, with the gentleman, or I don't know what to call him anyway, the man and his Pilegesh, the concubine, and first there was something that went wrong between the two of them, and she had left the house, and he went to get her back from her father's house, and he stayed a while and ate there and was welcomed in and so on, and then she agrees to go back with him, and after they finally get out of the house where they've been staying for 5 days, they're on their way back. He's agitated, he just wants to get home. They don't stop off in Yavuz, which is a non-Jewish city, and he feels may not be safe, as well as he's in a rush. And instead they go to Givah, this nice Jewish town. They can't find a place to stay. Finally, someone who's also a stranger takes them into his home. And the house is attacked at night by a band of ruffians from the city. And they say to turn over the guests, and they're going to abuse them. And the head of the house offers his own daughter. The guest offers the Pilagesh. And they're not interested. The crowd is not interested. The man takes his Pilagesh, takes the concubine, and throws her out of the house to them. And they abuse her. And ultimately, she gets back to the doorstep, and she dies on the doorstep. So it appears roughly in terms of the story. Obviously, we spent a few weeks on this. This wasn't simple and straightforward by any stretch of the imagination. We talked about the parallels to the story of Lot and Sodom, and what this says about the Jewish people of the time. We noted that the text emphasizes there is no melech, there is no king, and as a result, there is no justice. This is not taken care of, meaning these people can get away with whatever they're going to do, and nothing is going to happen to them. But the man says, I insist, I'm going to get justice. Now suddenly he's a crusader. So he takes her body, he cuts it up into parts, and sends it all around the land, so that everybody will hear about this. He sends to every Shevet, to every tribe, which we believe from the text includes Binyamin. He wants everybody to know what happened, and they all gather in Mitzpah. Mitzpah being a central gathering place going back to the time of Yehoshua. And they say, we are going to act. There's only one tribe that doesn't show up, and that is Binyamin. And we talked about why Binyamin does not participate, and the dominant idea that emerged is that Binyamin does not participate because they are angry, not angry, how could people in our Shevet, in our tribe, do this? But how dare you come tell us what to do? It's for us to carry out justice. And so, instead of doing what they ought to do to the population of Givah, they actually stand in defense of Givah. And so there's an initial attack by the much larger group of 11 tribes, and they are not successful. They are driven back. In fact, they suffer serious casualties. Was it 18,000 the first time and 22,000 the second time? 40,000, I think, was the total of their casualties. The first time around, they suffer a loss of 22,000. Then they come back, they regroup, they ask God, should we continue to go war against our brethren Binyamin? And God says, go for it. And this time they suffer the loss of 18,000. So it's a total of a loss of 40,000. And at that point, they go back with Pinchas and they ask, you know, are we doing this, following the wrong path altogether? Maybe what we are doing is wrong. Should we stop? And God says, this time go, and you are going to succeed. We talked about why they did not succeed until now. The question of what's wrong, that they're, you know, why are they losing? And we gave a few different suggestions. One suggestion from Ramban, which Malvin built on as well, is that they're actually wrong. They're in the wrong. They should have said to Binyamin, carry out justice. They should not have attacked Binyamin. And since they are wrong, God does not assist them. And even though you'll say, well, there are many more of them, Nonetheless, Binyamin is fighting on their own territory, fighting for their own land, defending themselves, and they're going to be the stronger, fiercer fighters in this situation. And that's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is they were wrong in terms of the way they approached God with their question. They didn't ask the right question. The way that they approached it, and perhaps didn't even have Pinchas making the ask, so to speak, but the question was, who should go fight first? There's a hubris element here. Of course, this is what we should do. Instead of asking, should we do this, should we not do this, will we succeed, will we not, that's not the way they did it. They just said, who should go first? And so maybe that's why. And again, you can go back and listen to the recordings and look at the notes and see more. But that brings us to the third attack, which is where we are right now. So questions on everything that we've just reviewed in the last 5.5 minutes. No? Ha, this is easy. Okay. The problem with mitzvah is that it's really a generic name for a geographic feature. It's an overlook. So you have Mitzvah Ramon, Mitzvah Shmuel, you have all sorts of mitzvot, if you will. So the question is... This would have to be an area that will be north of Jerusalem, north of Yerushalayim, so it could be. It has to be outside of Binyamin's territory, but not far from it. That's basically what you'd be looking for. So, on these gatherings that they're doing, we had a discussion, which I don't plan to reopen, of whether they're gathering now, when they actually go to war, whether they gather before God in Shiloh, at the Mishkan, or whether they're in Beit El. And both words are being used here. Both, you can find sources, and you can find ideas to back up each of those. Okay, so that brings us to the third attack, and we started on the attack already last time and basically covered it, but I want to just go over this again quickly because it affects what's going to happen in what we're going to learn this week. So we had, as I left you on your sheet, you see it there, three groups of soldiers in the attacking force of the 11 tribes. Group A, which is an ambush group that's behind the city of Givah, meaning opposite the side where everybody's been. You have group B, which is the group that's going to attack Givah from the front of the city. And then you have group C, which are the rest of the fighters. And last time we gave them all sorts of different food. I'm not gonna play the game this time. But you have the rest of the fighters in group C. And the way it worked was, in chapter 20, sentence 29, in Chaf Chaf Tet, there was an ambush set by group A. That's the one that's behind the city. Then group B attacks the city from the front. They are only pretending to actually attack, so that Binyamin will pursue them, and then they're going to run away. And Binyamin's going to assume this is just like the first two times. And we've seen this tactic before, going back to Yoshua and the second war with Ai. This is not new to us. But apparently it's new to Binyamin. Because Binyamin goes racing after group B. They're then cut off from Givah. Group C comes off from elsewhere, and they rally. And group A attacks Givah. There are 25,000 people, 25,100 people dead. We'll talk about that number in a bit. And then group A destroys Givah and signals groups B and C it's time to go on the offensive and to demolish the fighting force of Binyamin. That's more or less what we saw in terms of the war. And again, there are nuances as to who was doing what and how it works. But that's basically what happened.
Are 25,000 dead in Givah? Are they the women and children who stayed behind? Like, are they killing, women and children?
So, number one, they are killing women and children. Number two, it does not include the 25,100. You know, the 25,100 are fighters. We don't get a census of the city population.
But they are killing the whole city.
They are killing everybody. Keep in mind, this is a war of Jews against Jews. And it is a massacre, and there are no good guys in this story.
How many people were in Givah altogether?
We don't know. We don't know. Keep in mind also, it's Givah, but it's also Binyamin who has come to defend them. Yeah. The 25,000 are not from Givah. We actually had that in the beginning. We said there were 600 or 700 from Givah, and the rest of them were from the rest of Binyamin.
So they're not just killing those bad people in Givah.
They are wiping out everybody.
The whole Binyamin.
Everybody, that is
anyone
correct.
Left out of Binyamin? Like, how many people are in Binyamin?
So we'll get there.
What is the justification?
There are people left, yes.
What is the justification for killing? It's not as though they're conquering.
So what they're doing essentially is they're wiping out this city and those who defend it. They're saying, if you chose to side with them, we ask you to come with us in order to punish the wrongdoers. And instead, you chose to defend them. It's on your head. That's the way that they look at it. That's the way they look at it. Again, we're going to see more about this and why they do it, which is not there yet. We have to get there. So, this is what happens when you have no leadership. This is what happens when people are left to their own devices. So we're up to Pasuk Mem Aleph, sentence 41 in chapter 20. Describing the ending of the war as group B, the one that had been fleeing from Gibeah, now turns around. V'ish Yisrael hafach. The people in group B, from the rest of Israel, not Binyamin, they turned around. V'yibahel ish Binyamin, and Binyamin suddenly panicked. Kira'a ki naga'a alav hara'a, because they saw, we're in trouble. V'yifnu lifnei ish Yisrael al derech hamidbar. So what did they try to do? They tried to race off to the wilderness. We're caught out of the city. There's smoke coming up from the city, remember. They see the city is in ruins. So they try to race out to the wilderness. V'hamilchama hid bikasu. But the war caught up to them. The warriors caught up to them. And those who came from the cities were destroying, destroyed them in their midst, which according to most commentators means that the ambush forces who had entered the cities are wiping out the population of the city. That's one way to take a look at it. The other way to look at it, which is Mitzudat David, is that the people from Binyamin who were still in their cities, not in Giva, but in other cities, they had come from the cities to save their warriors who are fleeing, and that they are killed. And then you get this really odd sentence. It sounds like a song. It sounds like a ballad that somebody composed about the war. It's in the voice of the warrior speaking. Kidru et Binyamin. Kidru, keter is a crown. So I imagine some of yours will translate this as to surround.
Encircle.
And to encircle, right? Encircle Binyamin. The other way to take the word keter is actually to wait for them. Either surround them or wait for them to come out. Here difuhu, run after them. Minucha hidrichuhu. Minucha hidrichuhu, in their place of rest, trample them. Or chase them from their place of rest. Either way. Ad nochach ha-giv'ah mi-mizrach shamesh. All the way to east of Giv'ah, the front of Giv'ah, mi-mizrach shamesh, from the front of Giv'ah, from the east. It's this weird line here. It's like a ballad. I think Ricky noted that when we learned last time, that this sounds like a song. It does.
Why do they use that, this grammatical form of hidrichu?
Because it's like,
well, instead of Radfu or something.
Right. It's a fancier form of the command, of the imperative. That's really what it is.
But Hidrichu is usually like
Tot.
Sorry?
Hadracha. Oh, hadracha. Yeah, but it doesn't have to be. It's it's a stronger and it's more ornate, and it's also stronger. It's stronger than Radfu. I think that's the way that I would look at it. You'd have to ask a real grammarian for a stronger opinion, but that's my sense of it. And then we get the death toll. Vayiblumi Binyamin shmona asar elef ish. 18,000 warriors of Binyamin fall. Es kol ela anchechayo. All of these are warriors. Vayifnu vayanusu hamidbara. And the remaining warriors, they fled out to the wilderness, El Sela Harimon, to Sela Harimon, which is an area, I guess, that's out in the wild. Vaya Olaluhu Bamisilos, but they caught up to them when they were on the paths leading up from the city. They caught them and they attacked them there. La'olel is a term for attacking them and harming them. Chameshes alafimish, that's another 5,000. So now we're at 23,000. We're building towards the 25,100. Vayad bikuhu acharav ad Gid'om. And they caught them afterwards up to the city of Gid'om, vayakumi menu al payim ish. And they got 2,000. So your total is 25,000. That's what they got. Sorry?
You're short 100.
Short 100. Vayihi kolanoflimi binyamin esrim v'chamisha elav ish. So all who fell from Binyamin were 25,000. Sholeif cherev. Those were the warriors, the ones with the swords. Bayom ahuf. They fell on that day. Eskol elahan shechayel. All of these were warriors. So the question is, what happened to the other 100 from the group? So Rashi... This is not Rashi. This is the following is from a 16th century work that's inserted into our text in Rashi. Megale Amukot says that they fled to Italy and Germany, and that this is what we were taught by Eliyahu Hanavi. Commentators generally assume that this line is actually inserted in the wrong place. It's not about the 100. It's about something we're going to see shortly, but it's not about the 100. It's reported afterwards, yeah. They count up their dead. I mean, that's not unusual. That's what happens after a war. They count up their casualties. Not a great job. Rabbah gives what is generally assumed to be the answer, which is that here we're talking in round numbers. Earlier, the 25,100, even that's probably a round number. Yeah, but certainly here, we're just giving general this number here and this number here. But this next part is the fascinating part. We still have to, our numbers are still not going to work out because of another reason that we'll have to come back to. But right now, it sounds like 25,000 dead or 25,100 dead. Vayifnu vayanusu hamidbara el sela harimon sheish meos ish. 600 of them fled to Sela Harimon.
But they were just there.
So the flight was to Sela Harimon, but 600 were successful.
They didn't get there. The 5,000 or whatever
got killed. 600 made it. Vayeshvu b'Sela Harimon arba'a chadashim. They wait for 4 months in Sela Harimon. So there are 600 who made it.
Out of the whole tribe of Benjamin, all the
you got it. That's all your. That's all your warriors that remain.
Just the warriors.
Just the warriors, yeah. Which is who counts for this thing. Yes, we'll see.
So any other people?
The women, yes. And children of.
They didn't destroy all the cities of Benjamin, but all the men.
Right. All the women and children of Gibeah, and not all the women and children of the rest of Benjamin.
That's correct. Right.
Just to be
so the rest. So what's going to happen to all these women that are left?
Well, that's where we're going. The Ish Yisrael.
At Gibeah, they destroyed them.
Gibeah is gone.
But in other cities, there were left. So
whoever did it.
Women.
Correct.
Right.
Would
Benjamin one of the largest tribal populations at that time?
No,
like, or
I don't believe so. I think they're Amish.
How many were there?
We don't get a census here, but if you go back to when we did Yehoshua, mm-hmm. I don't believe they were the largest. Then Reuben and Yehuda were the two largest, if I remember correctly. But I may be remembering wrong. But either way, I don't think that they stood out as being the largest, no.
I still have trouble with my re-grasping these thousands and thousands in this tiny little country. Does it make sense, or do you think...
What do you mean? It's a big country.
100,000 and...
You have millions living there now, and they're not covering the whole land.
Yeah.
But now we have high-rises.
It's true. There's still an awful lot of land that people are not living on yet, north and south. V'ish Yisrael shavu el b'nei Binyamin. So the warriors from the rest of Israel went back to B'nai Binyamin. Vayakum l'ficher meir misom ad behema ad kolanim tzah. And they're killing out all the men they can find. This is men that we're talking about here, I believe. From the cities, everybody down to the animals. Ad kolanim tzah, whatever is found. Gam kol ha'arim anim tzahos shulchub ha'esh. Maybe it's not just the men. They set the cities on fire. They're destroying whatever they find. I know that the women are surviving because that's what's happening in the next parak, in the next chapter. That's why I say that. But
well, just going to turn their back on the children. What does that mean?
Where are you looking?
48.
The men of Israel turned back upon the children of Binyamin.
Oh, no, okay, so that's a mistranslation. Yeah. It means the people
like
of Binyamin.
Binyamin,
like Bnei Israel. Yeah, I don't understand why they would use the term children there. It means the people of Binyamin, the Benjaminites. Okay. But the problem that we have is this. Go back to Pasuk Tetvav, sentence 15.
1-5?
Yes, that's the one. And tell me how many fighters there were.
That's
4 of the 700. 26,700, right?
Yeah.
26,000 from Binyamin, and 700 from
Kippah. Yeah.
And again, these may be slightly round numbers. But how many dead are there? 25,100. And then we can account for another 600.
Right.
We have another 600 who fled. That's
right.
How many?
28,000.
27. 25-1 plus 600 is 25-7.
Yeah.
We're missing 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to them?
What's 1,000?
So, a few different approaches. Take a look at your sheet. Source number 2 is Rashi. Rashi says, V'yesh l'smoma al elef hechanim. What happened to the other 1,000? So he answers, V'ha'elef baruchu aleh arim. These 1,000 fled back to the cities. V'nachlu l'macharaz kishashavu b'nei Yisrael alarei b'nyamim. What we just read about them going around to the cities, that's when they got the 1,000. That's the idea. That's when they...
somewhere back to whoever they found.
Right.
It's like terrible. They killed enough.
That's one answer.
Terrible.
Second answer is Radak. Take a look at source number 3. This also is the view of Ralbag and Abarbanel. And that is, we had 2 battles before this. Right? Where everybody else lost 22,000 and 18,000. So he says, it could be. They fell in the first war, Yisrael, when the rest of Israel were struck. It's not like there was no death toll on the Binyamin side. But the text only listed those who died when Binyamin was defeated. It didn't mention the 1,000 from those first 2 battles. And then he quotes you this very odd midrash, which is the one also that's in that Rashi about the 100 from before, but we generally assume it should be here. The midrash omer, ki osan ala hachula eretz romania vayesh vusham. They went to Italy. They left.
There is an old community in Rome. Like
there is.
And
they'll claim that this is their origin.
They claim that this, yeah.
Do they
claim they're from
Binyamin?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know what they claim now, but that's what the that's what this odd...
Yeah.
I don't know if call it a medrash or don't call it a medrash because it's not the style of medrash, but that's the idea. In the same way that the Ethiopian Jews have their story of how they got there, and the Jews in India have their story. So evidently, someone is saying, "Yeah, we've been here since Pilagish Begiva," which is really terrible when you think about it. Like, why would you claim this as your heritage? This is not where you want to be from. Like, Daddy, how did we get here? Well, it's a long story.
But it's the same as the Australians say, their great-great-grandfather.
They don't like that either.
Convict. Some of them they do. They think it's acceptable.
Yeah, but this is, I don't know, this is
so
weird.
Why didn't they go after the ones who were in Rimon?
So that's what's coming next.
Okay.
That's what's coming next. Theoretically, that should be the next phase. So what we see right now is a war that seems to be no longer a war to punish the people of Giva, or even to teach Giva a lesson. This is a war of elimination.
Annihilation.
We are annihilating the tribe of Binyamin.
Yeah.
And that's when they realize just what a mistake they've made.
But God told them the last time to go. And
Yes, but he didn't tell them to wipe everybody out.
Yeah.
There's no leadership here. So the key themes we're going to see in this next paragraph, this last chapter of Shoftim, and this is the last chapter of Shoftim, ending on a low note, is people who are trying to do right going absurdly wrong. That's what you're going to see here. You're going to see the lack of leadership, but you're going to see them put the blame in entirely the wrong places for what they've done. end, what you will see is the Jews becoming more like the Canaanites they are meant to replace.
Well, they haven't got any other role models.
Well, that's, again, we talked about why this story is stuck at the end. One of the highlights is this explains why you need a king. Sorry?
Then they have no role models.
Right.
The only people around them are Canaanites, and they've only been...
And they're horrific.
Out of slavery for a few years.
Well, the question is, when does this story take place? Is this from the beginning of the era or the end of the era? If it's the beginning of the era, then yeah, they only came into the land 30 years ago.
But God doesn't speak to anybody. God doesn't intervene. But God doesn't set
things up.
I mean, Pinchas, when they ask the question, they get an answer. But God is clearly... not approving, just from the fact that we don't get a shofet here. There is nobody appointed to lead them. There's no, God doesn't speak to anybody and say, okay, this is what they ought to do, and convey a message. We've seen that with other shofim, like with Devorah or Gidon, right? Hashem sent a malach or a navi to come to them and say, here's what I want you to do. Right, Devorah, go to war against Canaan. Gidon, I want you to rally the Jews, destroy the Avodah Zarah, destroy the idolatry, and then rally the Jews against Midian. Here we got nothing. There isn't even a Vatehi Ala Ruach Hashem, that someone had some kind of inspiration. There's nothing.
But they're Kohanim. He can communicate through Kohen Gadol or...
Someone asked Pinchas. And they did once. And the question was, so, you know, what should we be doing in this war? Not how far should we go, but should we attack, will we succeed? So...
It's just one-way communication. God doesn't give any messages through.
Correct. God does not initiate with them. So that brings us to Perek Chaf Aleph, chapter 21, Psukim Aleph to Dalet, sentences 1 to 4. And this is remorse, we will see. The Ish Yisrael nishba b'mitzvah lemor, Ish mimenu lo yitein bito levinyamin leisha. This sentence is... actually a description of what had already happened when they were at Mitzvah. They're not at Mitzvah anymore. When they had their gathering at Mitzvah, then they had taken the following oath. The oath was, no one should marry off their daughter to people from Binyamin.
So mostly dead.
Well, no, they're not dead. This vow was made earlier. This vow was made earlier. Again,
they heard about it, and that's why Binyamin also.
No, and this was for the women. This was the women.
No, this is right now not allowed to marry the men.
That is exactly correct. Vayavoham, I just want to read the first four psukim, and then we're going to discuss them. Vayavoham Beit El. So now, war's over. The nation that has won the war gathers in Beit El. And they sat there until evening before God, and again, before God in Beit El, because God is present when we gather, or they brought the Aron from the Mishkan, or Beit El is really Shiloh, all the different explanations you can offer for Lifnei HaElokim. Vayis'u kolam, and they raised their voices, vayivku b'chi gadol, and they cried mightily. Vayamru, and they said, Lama Hashem Elokei Yisrael Haisazos B'Yisrael. Why, God, did this happen? Lipaked Hayom B'Yisrael Shevet Echad, such that an entire tribe should be lost from Israel. This is terrible. Right? They're just flying from one extreme to another. Vayimi Macharas, the next day, Vayashkimu Ha'am, the nation got up early, Vayivnu Sham Mizbeach, they built an altar, Vayalu Olosu Shlamim, and they brought burnt offerings and Shlamim, peace offerings, before God. What question should we be asking on these four sentences we just read?
When it says the people...
presumably this means the soldiers and leaders of whatever variety there. No.
Is there one leader who sort of...
In other words, they're regretting what they did.
Puts it on Facebook for everybody.
That we don't know. Except that if it was on Facebook, his data is gone.
Yeah.
What else should we be asking here?
Why now
all of a sudden they're thinking about God?
Well, now, because it's over, the war is over. Now we have to stop and think. First of all, why do they regret what they did? Meaning they were so sure that this is what they ought to do. What changed their minds? That's a question you have to ask. Another question. What do they mean when they ask, why did this happen? They know why it happens. We did it. Like, what do you mean? Right? You broke into a car, right? You broke into a car, you stole stuff, and then you got caught. And you turn to God and say, why, God? Why did this happen? Well, you know.
Yeah, but sometimes you get carried away at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, and
but what is
just
the,
get out of control, and everybody goes along with it, and then somebody, you finally say, what am I doing?
But what am I doing is different from why, God.
Why God?
I think what Essie said is exactly my question. Are they blaming God?
Yeah, God made you do it.
How come you didn't stop us?
Yeah. Why God? When God says, well, why people?
Why did you let us?
Why did you let us, maybe? And then why are you building a Mizbeach here? You have a Mizbeach here. Whether this is Beit El or Shiloh, you have a Mizbeach here. And what are the karbanot? What are these offerings about? So let's go back first to this oath, this deal they had made, this statement of no one should marry them. So this is mistake number one in this chapter. There are multiple mistakes in this chapter. This is mistake number one in this chapter, and it is the refusal to marry them. Which, note, is a refusal to marry not just Givah, but Binyamin as a whole.
Yeah, but it says Binyamin.
Yeah, no, it's Binyamin as a whole.
There's only 600 of them left.
But you're saying it's the men.
That's
right.
The men.
Right. Again, this vow was made... Hang on, stop. This vow was made before the war.
Before the war, yeah, right.
Before the war.
But those widowed women, they could marry
a
man.
They could marry a man. So what's the goal?
Well, they become
part of a new tribe.
Correct. You're annihilating the whole
Shevet. Well, you're not, assuming that you're not expecting to demolish the army.
Right.
But that is what you're doing. You are annihilating the Shevet because you're going to war planning to win. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be a problem.
Well, why did they have to kill?
So the answer to that seems to be they got carried away.
Okay.
They're
over.
I don't think they expected to wipe out the Shevet initially. I think what they expected, though, was to do what we're seeing now, which is to cut them off from everybody else. If they want to have a future Binyamin, it's only going to work internally. Because the only way their men, who are the ones who perpetuate the name of Binyamin, can get married is to marry a woman from Binyamin. Mm-hmm. It's isolation. And that's what Radak notes. Take a look on your sheet, please, at number 4. He says, Nasnuo sam kemo minudim. They set them up as excommunicated people. Shelo yischatnu bam od, not to marry among them anymore. Al hanabala zos asher asu. Because of this terrible thing they had done, achar shelo nasnu arishraim ba'poshim, because they, Binyamin, didn't hand over the wicked people and the sinners. Since they defended evil, fine, we're not going to have anything to do with them. We are cutting them off. They will be their own community now. That's the idea. They're going to be isolated from everybody else. And that's one way to look at it.
But there had to be men left to...
Yeah, but again, this is before the war.
Oh, this is still before the war. Okay,
right.
That they said this.
Mm-hmm. Right, that's the idea. Okay.
So is that why they left the guys who left you remote?
We're not done with them yet. We're going to get to them. We're going to get to them. So that's one. That's one read. But the Da'at Mikra, Professor Eli Tzur in the Da'at Mikra edition, offers another element to it. He says, "Remember how we got to this place. Remember what triggered all of this, right? The events in Givah." So he says, Midah keneged midat hazima shel anasei Binyamin. This is measure for measure against the immorality of what they did to the concubine in Givah. Ubazevik shuli hibadel mikmeal adat hachataim. They thought, we are going to be separated from the sinners. In other words, if you had not been immoral, none of this would have happened. So therefore, we don't want to engage with you. We don't want any involvement with you. This is they think they're doing something righteous. Now, I should note one key point that the Gemara makes. Take a look at source number 6. This is a Gemara we're going to have to come back to, because it has much bigger ramifications as we go through this story. We're not going to get to the rest of it this week. But this is the Gemara about Tu B'Av. You're familiar with Tu B'Av? It's the 15th day of the month of Av. It is considered one of two great days, the two greatest days on our calendar, Yom Kippur and Tu B'Av. But whereas for Yom Kippur, everybody knows why Yom Kippur is a great day. It's the day of forgiveness. Right? Hashem says, I've established this day as a day of purification and forgiveness. That was the day when Moshe came down with the second set of tablets that indicated we were forgiven for the golden calf. It's a wonderful day. We don't really know what Tu B'Av is. Hang on, we'll get to both of those. Not this week. That's coming in a future week. Just wait with it, please. Really, the Gemara at the end of Tanis goes through five or six different explanations for what makes that such a festival. What is it about Tu B'Av that makes it such a wonderful day? And one of the things they say is that that was when the decree against marrying into Binyamin was ended. Meaning, it wasn't a permanent thing. And the Gemara asks, how do you know it wasn't meant to be permanent? So that's what you see here in source number 6. Yom Shehutar Shevet Binyamin Lavo Bakahal. That was the day when the tribe of Binyamin was allowed again to marry among the nation. My Darush. What was the basis? How did they know that it will be permitted after at some point? So Amarav Mimenu Velomi Banenu. The answer is, if you go back to look at the text that listed their vow, the vow was Ish Mimenu Lo Yitain Bitel LeBinyamin LeIsha. One of us may not give his daughter. All of us who are standing here, who are part of this pact, we may not marry off our daughters to Binyamin. However, anyone who's not here, the future generations, they're allowed to marry off their daughters to Binyamin. So therefore, it was only a one-generation pact, and therefore it wouldn't eliminate them. It's simply for one generation, we are isolating them. That's the idea. Now,
is it Tu B'Av, a particular Tu B'Av, or every Tu B'Av?
Every 15th of Av is a celebration. You mean, this happened on a particular day. That was the day when they said, you know what? We can't, but the next generation can. When they made it a formal declaration.
The following Tu B'Av after this? Or?
So we don't actually know. We're not told. Mm-hmm. We're not told when. It's a good question.
Like how many years later?
Yeah.
Yes, we do not know. It's not recorded within the book itself. That we don't know. So that's the oath, right? It's an oath of isolation, excommunication. It's an oath to say we are so horrified by what they did, we don't want them marrying any of us, right? We don't want men from a place like that to marry us, at least, correct, in this generation. But now there's a sense of regret for what this is going to bring about. Because if they don't have men, right? They don't have, what you have are 600 men who have survived, right? That's all you have. Who are they going to be able to marry?
The women of Binyamin.
Except that now we go back to the question of what the status of their cities is. We ask the question of whether the women were killed within the city.
Were they married before they left for war?
Sorry?
Were they married before they left for war?
Possibly. But at this point, the cities are destroyed, and yeah, it sounds like they also killed out the women. Otherwise, the rest of the story doesn't make any sense. Right, so they killed the cities that are listed here. I guess the answer has to be that, yes, there are
some women.
The answer is that they have a problem. They killed out the women also.
Oh.
That's the way you have to read the story. I didn't realize it, but yeah, you have to read the story that way.
Because there's only
600 people left total.
Yes.
Men.
600 men, and that's it.
And they can't marry. So from a few generations later, you have Shaul and all the 600 men that are left.
That's the way you would look at it, yeah. Now keep in mind, it depends on when the story... No, you have to keep in mind when the story took place. According to everybody but Radak and maybe Abarbanel, this story took place 300 years ago. You had 300 years for them to rebuild the ship. Yeah. This story happens 30 years after they enter the land, and the story of Amon and their fight with Yiftach was 300 years after that. By the time you get to the era of Shaul, you've got, I think, 370 or so years. I don't remember exactly, but I think that it's basically a 400-year period for the Shoftim, right? So that you have 370 years that have passed. So yes, time has passed.
Why is it here?
So, right, so we gave a number of different reasons for why it would be recorded at the end. One explanation for why it's at the end is to highlight the need for leadership, because that's what's going to happen in Shmuel, is you're going to have a king. That's one explanation for why it's at the end. Another explanation...
But it still took all those years, then, to even have a king.
Correct.
We only have the Shoftim, then, like it's saying, we need it.
And look what happens.
Yes. With all these Shoftim that weren't working,
Shoftim were not
and
adequate.
Then we finally get to...
Correct.
Okay.
That's one explanation. Another is because this and the story of Shimshon, this and the story of Pesel Micha don't have a Shoftim involved. So the way to look at it is, the book begins with stories about our wars, their first couple of chapters. Then we get all the stories involving Shoftim, and then we get two stories at the end that didn't involve a Shoftim. These are actually civil wars and issues among the Jews. So it's the second explanation. We gave a few different explanations.
It was really Yeshua, when he died, and there was nobody to take over from him. And there was a period before the
first Shoftim of Othniel ben Kenaz. That's the main view, yes. But Abinel doesn't like it so much. Radak thinks that it's not true. But yeah, that's the general view. How will Radak explain that you have, you know, a Shaul later on? His answer will be, you didn't have a large Shevet. So, you just had some. That's the way Radak will read it. I mean, you do have. I shouldn't, you know, we know how long a period you have. You have basically 50 years from the end of the Shoftim until Shaul. That's your period of time. Because Shmuel is 52 years old when he dies. He's born in the time of Eli, who is after this. Eli is the leader after this, and he coronates Shaul and then David.
It's for sure possible. I'm just wondering if Binyamin rebuilt itself. Like, before the exile of the Shvatim, they were one of the two Shevets, right?
Right.
Binyamin is the census that,
Right. I don't know.
No, and even though, I mean, if there were 600 men,
and
presumably not...
Then you get 600 women in
the story. Maybe not every single woman was killed.
I mean, the story makes it sound like it, but it's difficult to know.
And also, some of them could have... how do we know that everybody listened? I mean, maybe...
Well, no, because we'll see where this is going.
Oh.
We're not done. You'll see where this is going. Believe me. You think you're horrified now. You haven't even seen anything yet. I mean, you have, but still, there's worse coming. So why do they regret at this point? The simple read of it is they regret it because the price is really high. They recognize what they've done. They didn't anticipate, you know, what they were going to do, the wiping out of the women and the men. They didn't anticipate the toll of the war, and that's one take. But Ramban says, "I told you so." Take a look at source number 7. He says they realized they were wrong the whole time. After the deed, they regretted it. They recognized their error and the punishment that was now befalling them as a result. They said, you know, what we should have done is we should have told Binyamin, you carry out justice. We should not have sought to we should have put their back against the wall by seeking to carry it out ourselves.
But where does he come to that? Like, what makes him decide
Say that they were wrong?
Yeah.
So we went through this back when, no, that's all right, but I'm just, we won't reopen the whole thing, but his argument is, number one, there's no death penalty coming for the city of Givah. You can't even prove who it was who killed her. That's number one. Mm-hmm. Number two is that justice is supposed to be carried out by local authorities. And you came in like gangbusters saying, turn over the city to us. Yeah, instead of saying, Binyamin, do something about this.
Okay.
So yeah, that's essentially the view.
Okay.
The question in Pasuk Gimel, though, in sentence 3, is so why are you blaming God? What is this approach to God of God? Why did this happen? You know exactly why this happened. Who are you kidding? So Abarbanel says, if we hadn't lost Abarbanel says, let's see what he says, and then I'll explain it. Take a look at number 8. he says, it's a little bit convoluted. He says, he says, I think that the Jews are complaining about two things. Ha'echad, first of all, that they lost 40,000 people in the first two battles. Well, ze amru lama Hashem Elokei Yisrael, I saw zos be Yisrael. So they said, God, why did this happen in Israel? Their question of why is about the 40,000. Vasheni hu amro li baked mi Yisrael shevet echad, and then he splits the statement. The second half of the statement is, it's so terrible that we're going to lose a tribe. Rotzalomar, meaning, im ha'isah magei fasher nafla ba'das Yisrael bi'ilachamam im ha'ivim b'lochdam ir mivtzar mehem. Ubeid Mikdash Melech Hecharashti. They said, you know, this is such a waste. If we had lost 40,000 people because we were fighting the enemies and conquering their cities and conquering their capital, right? So, you know, all right, we would say, look, this is what happens. This was what our mission was. But we suffered this harm to get to such a terrible end. Destroying a tribe from Israel. So the way Abarbanel reads it is they're saying to God, why did we have to lose 40,000 people for this in order to eliminate a Shevet? That's what they're upset about. That's the way Abarbanel reads it. It's not how could we have destroyed a Shevet? It's God, you know, what was this all for? Why did we have to lose 40,000 people?
Showing them how low they all were.
Right.
Can you imagine one bad man created all this?
Yeah. Well, not really, because it's the people. It's the people who attacked.
That's probably not the isolated.
He's the one who made the other people seek vengeance.
But that's all.
When he was so white and pure,
he could have gone home and not said
it
or done anything, and none of this would happen.
Exactly.
Right.
I think that it's part of the general attitude, the general atmosphere at the time. I'm sure it wasn't an isolated. I'm sure there were things that were building up.
Presumably, this is a culture in the city, and that's what they think. That's why they're raiding the city. It's not just a one-time event, although we did see Malbim paint that potentially that way. So Abarbanel's read really is, at this stage, they're not expressing regret for what they did in the war, right? They're upset that they suffered a death toll in order to do this. But generally speaking, the commentators other than Abarbanel read this not as blaming God. They read it as it's really about us. And the invocation of God is in saying this is about us. Take a look at Malbim in number 9. He says, Achar she'im lo hayu Yisrael noflim b'shtei pa'amim harishonim. Had we not suffered the loss of 40,000 the first two times, lo hayu machrim es Binyamin ad lechalei. We would not have destroyed Binyamin to this point. Meaning, the reason why we went so far was because they killed 40,000 of us. And that was what catalyzed our desire to kill them. Vayu ma'anishim asachotim levad. If not for that, we would have just punished those who had sinned. That would be it. V'lo la'arok taf v'nashim la'shmid akol. Not killing the women, the children, and everything. Ve'ata bo lifnei Hashem. So now they come to God. Yoshvim u'bochim. Sitting and crying. U'mechafsim v'chokrim ma'ya sibah lazeh. And they're asking, what made this happen? L'machara af Hashem b'mat sh'naflu b'melchama b'shtei pa'amim harishonim. Why was God so angry at us that he would cause us to lose the first two times? What did we do wrong? This is actually self-examination. Why did we suffer the loss of 40,000? Where did we go wrong? Such that we caused the loss of a Shevet in Israel. That's the way that Malbim reads the sentence. See, let me go back a step because I think I didn't adequately explain this. Look at sentence 3. Look at Pasuk Gimel, please. Because this is really what you have to notice in order to understand what the commentators are bothered by. They ask the following: Lama Hashem Elokei Yisrael Haisas Zos Bi Yisrael. Why God did this happen in Israel? Liyipaked Hayom Mi Yisrael Shevet Echad, for a single Shevet to be lost from Israel. Right? You see that? So the simple way to read this sentence is, why did this happen in Israel? Meaning, leave Bakate. It's a single united sentence, meaning the loss of a tribe. It's one point. Why did this happen? Meaning the loss of a tribe. That's the way that I would read the sentence as a simple sentence. And Ramban reads it, I think, along those lines. It's a recognition of, we were wrong, we messed up, how could we have reached this point? Abarbanel and others, though, including Malbim, are saying, no, it's two different halves of the sentence. Abarbanel reads it as, why did we suffer the loss of 40,000 just for the sake of eliminating a tribe in Israel?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's the way Abarbanel reads the sentence. And then Malbim reads the sentence as, why did we lose 40,000, which drove us to eliminate a tribe in Israel? Why did we suffer the loss of 40,000? What did we do wrong such that we lost the 40,000, and therefore we eliminated the Shevet? And that's another way to look at it. And then finally, Metsudat David, in number 10. Metsudat David fits the context very well of what's coming next. Bizarre context, but you'll see.
But I don't see anywhere that it says 40,000.
Well, no, but the problem is, what's the Zot?
I see it as, if I did something bad, I say, oh God, how could I have done that?
No, but what's the Zot? When it says, Lama Hashem Elkeisol Haita Zot be Yisrael, what is the Zot referring to? What is the meaning of the word Zot?
Whatever happened.
What is whatever happened?
Everybody being killed.
Everybody from whom being killed?
Everywhere.
Our own?
Yeah, so many people died.
But then it's not about me. I wasn't trying to have my own people die.
Yeah, I was, by going to war. I mean, obviously, you're going to lose people.
Yeah, but that doesn't speak to regret for my actions. It's only if I'm going to say, this had to have been... again, why would I say Lama Hashem? Why God? You have two different ways to read it, and then you just, after that, you're just figuring out the second one. Meaning, either this is one sentence. God, why did this happen in Israel? Meaning, the loss of a tribe. Right? And that's, I think, the most simple and straightforward read. The other way to say it is, why did our loss happen in Israel? The loss of a tribe. Our loss, meaning the loss of the 40,000. And then the question is, what connects the two? And either you take a Barbanel's read, that the connection between the first and the second is, one was the death toll, and the other is what the goal was, the loss of a tribe, which they say doesn't warrant our death toll. Or Malbim, who says, why did we suffer the loss of 40,000, which moved us to cause the death of a tribe, the loss of a tribe? And then I really want to get to Metsudat David here before we finish. Metsudat David says, Lama ba'a al yadeinu takala kazot lachsir mi Yisrael shevet echad, uki'ilu shalu la'arotam ma la'asot la'amida shevet. He says, he's reading it as a unified sentence, like Ramban read it before, and like the simple read. It's a single unified sentence. But he says, is they're not asking God, how could you have done this? They're asking for advice. What do we do now to avoid the loss of a shevet? I didn't translate the word takala primarily because it's a hard word to translate. Takala is like something going wrong, becoming bad, and it doesn't translate well as an English word, and also because I wanted to fit everything on one page, and anything I was doing was making the line too long, and I was getting stuck. So I just said, you know what, takala. It doesn't have a good translation.
It's almost like an accident. Something bad happened, a catastrophe, something like that.
Yeah. Why did this terrible thing happen to us? To eliminate a tribe from Israel. So he's reading it as one long sentence. And he's saying, not why, God, but to say, why should this happen? Maybe there's something we can do to prevent it.
Yes.
Which they're going to come up with.
Well, but there's no evidence for that in the sentence.
Well, the evidence is the context, because that's what they're going to do, is they're going to go on from here with their idea.
Okay.
So that's, I think that he's going based on context.
Oh, okay.
Last bit here. the mizbeach that they built, the karbanot that they bring. What's that about? So Abarbanel says, now they've come to apologize. In number 11, he says, Ra'u, they saw. They said, you know what? We are guilty. We're not great either. And we talked about their guilt, and we talked about what was wrong. That was another connection between this and Pesel Micha, was the idea that they're guilty because they didn't protest over the idol of Micha. Now they're upset. They weren't upset about idolatry. So whatever the guilt is, they're upset about that. They knew. They recognized it. God was punishing them the first two times. So now the karbanot are to apologize. That's one read. I think the most basic and simple read. It's an apology.
But did you say they built the second mizbeach?
Yes, because they want to show how bad they feel. That's one way. Ralbag says, you know, we have a history of people vowing karbanot when they're saved from a terrible or dangerous situation or in war, like Yiftach, frankly. So he says in number 12, this is part of a longer comment from him, but he says, Ulay nadru shem yitein Hashem et Binyamin biyadam yasu zehanyam lechvod Hashem. Maybe they had taken a vow. If we win, we're going to build an altar, bring karbanot and all that. Having nothing to do with the regret. And then the last explanation, which is in Nadak, Mitzvot David also, is that this is part of seeking guidance from God. They build a new Mizbeach. He says, building the altar was an act of seeking God. We see that in many places in Tanakh. You want to approach God, you build an altar. That's what you do. So that's what they're looking for. They're looking for guidance at this point. So what we see here, and we're gonna halt here. We're not gonna see the bizarre idea they come up with. And either you read ahead or you take me on my word, boy. But they've routed Binyamin. They've wiped out the population, all the warriors except for 600. They wiped out the population of the cities. This seems to be what you have left, and they have an existing vow that the men from Binyamin are not going to be able to marry women from outside the tribe. So what is going to happen to Shevet Binyamin, to the tribe of Binyamin? This was a mistake, the refusal to marry them. They went overboard, and there's going to be a price to be paid. Now, they come and complain about what happened. Either they're saying, this is terrible, the loss of a tribe is terrible, we regret the loss of a tribe, and it's about themselves, or they're blaming God for the loss of the 40,000 the first two times, and saying, well, that was what drove us here, but now we have to ask ourselves, why did God do this to us? What was it that we did wrong, a la Malvim, or what is it that we can do now to avoid the loss, as Mitzudat David reads reads this? But that's what they're... That's what they're trying to deal with here, is the aftermath of such a terrible disaster, and they're going to try to come up with a way to save the Sheva, to save this tribe. Yeah, not a happy one. Next week is also not a happy one, but it'll be interesting, that's for sure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.